well past the point of whether AI is going to play a key role in the industry. As an industry, we need to work together, operationalize AI responsibly with full transparency and disclosure. But I do think AI is going to force our industry to innovate faster than ever.
Hello, and welcome to the DPP podcast. I'm Edward Qualtro, editorial director here at the DPP, and that was Kevin Riley, CTO at Avid. In February 2024, the DPP published a new report titled AI in Media, What Does Good Look Like? That work was written and researched by the DPP's Rowan de Pomeray, and Kevin was one of the dozens of contributors to the work. Another expert practitioner involved in the project was Google product manager and fellow media industry expert Malika Golkaram. So, in another DPP podcast two-parter, we will hear from Kevin and Rowan discussing AI innovations, the biggest areas of maturity and opportunity for AI in media workflows, and who should have ethical and business oversight of artificial intelligence initiatives. And then we will hear from Malika about what's really changed in AI in the last 6 years and what she is most excited about. In part two, we will hear from the BBC's Morag McIntosh discussing case studies at the BBC and Atelier CTO Ryan Kiddo. But first, here is that expertise from Kevin, Malika and Rowan.
Hi, Kevin. Hi, Rowan. Thank you very much for joining the DPP podcast. I'm going to go to you first of all, Rowan, and ask you to give a brief introduction about the DPP work that's been released, its full title, and perhaps a couple of key insights as well that have come out.
Yeah, so the full title is AI in Media, What Does Good Look Like? And there's a couple of sort of meanings to that title. So we've really looked at both the maturity of AI across the media industry. So, you know, what do good solutions look like? What does effective AI look like? And the second is, what does it mean to do good and be good with AI? So there's a chapter called Responsible AI. So being brief is a challenge when it comes to this work. There is so much to say about AI at the moment and so much that has been said. But actually, you know, what we've really tried to do is give a good overall summary and to divide it into three quite discrete chapters that explain a little bit about what AI technology looks like today, a little bit about how mature its use is across our industry and what the potential is, and then a section about that kind of responsible use, governance, ethics, and copyright concerns and all sorts. So hopefully it's a useful reference to people. And even if you're only interested in part of that, you can download it and read the relevant chapter. But as for key insights, it's hard to pull out sort of specific pithy takeaways. But I think I would say that simultaneously, we are at a key moment in the development of AI for our industry. And in particular, I think we'll come to this later, but a key moment that is drawing the whole organization into a piece of technology change. So it's, you know, it's a set of tech developments that are affecting everybody from creative to legal to HR, not just the tech teams. And yet simultaneously that it's just a continual evolution and a continual development. You know, when we were looking at maturity, we were finding a lot of the tools and techniques that have actually been around for a number of years sort of slowly starting to bed in and deliver value. So for all the talk of generative AI, there's a lot of good old-fashioned common old garden machine learning that's really starting to come into its own as well.
Thank you. And if you're not going to give me any pithy takeaways, I'm sure Kevin will. So Kevin, we spoke a lot about AI at the European Broadcaster Summit, a DPP event. We had people from across the industry there, and now you've been involved in this piece of work as well. So I know you've been involved in this space for quite a while, but and I don't expect you to have an encyclopedic knowledge of Rowan's report, but could you give us some of your key takeaways or things that particularly resonated with work you're doing? It could be work that Avid does or things that you see among your customers.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Edward. I think at the meta level, I would characterize what we're seeing is really a strong desire to leverage AI around the creative process, right? How do you automate and simplify the front end and back end of workflows in a way that lets creatives focus more deeply on the creative process itself? I think within the creative process, we are seeing increasing trust in things like algorithmic improvements and automation, things like speech to text, localization, blurring, object tracking, things of that nature. These are safer use cases, that we're hearing back from kind of our industry that are just a little, there's a higher level of comfort to operationalize those. I would say, what we see is the industry starting with what I would characterize as operational improvements versus things like AI-driven content creation, which is, a little bit more controversial at the moment. But nonetheless, Tip to what Rowan said, I do think we are at a key point in our industry because AI is here. It is going to play a key role in helping media organizations keep up with what I call the content creation arms race, and also be able to do that facing increasing budget pressures.
Thank you. And in the piece of work, Rowan sort of identified almost the whole media sort of video creation workflow, and we've assigned these well thought through, but we've attached the figures to them based on some industry research and surveys of what is the industry potential and what is the current technology maturity. So how do you see some of that playing out in different parts of our industry and the creation of video content and distribution of video content? Of where's AI really delivering value, and where are, the innovations possibly slightly lagging where people think we will eventually get?
Yeah, it's a great question. And there's a third category, which is what we like to call within Avid the stupid pet tricks. It's kind of AI for AI's sake, but we'll ignore those for now. If I kind of think about the workflow across four main buckets in terms of ingest, production, content management, distribution, just kind of take them in that order. Now, I think around ingest, we do see significant value in this area because I think AI has the potential to dramatically reduce the time to production. But we're not really seeing the industry converge yet there in terms of maturity of that technology. I think we've talked about a lot of very relevant use cases around things like auto tagging, metadata gathering and management, automated project creation and jumpstarting into, production, but haven't quite fully seen that take hold yet in our industry. But we do believe in those use cases. So I put that in the category of this value, but not quite there yet. In the production part of the workflow, we do see value now. I tipped into one of the main areas earlier, which is around algorithms. We do see AI-based algorithms maturing very fast around, in areas of speech to text, object tracking, crop, blurring, image enhancements, et cetera. This domain tends to be pretty black and white. Algorithms always evolve and have been tested against each other for a long time in our industry. And we have proven techniques for evaluating and upgrading algorithms. So that's a pretty straightforward area where I do think AI is properly infused today and will continue to establish an increasing beachhead there. Another area where I do think that is ripe for adoption within production, besides just algorithmic enhancements that kind of augment the creative process, is certainly in the areas of self-help. And I'll tip into this a little later when I'm sure you're going to ask me about what I think about the future. But with the advancements in large language models and the ability to ground models in very specific domains, we are seeing a nice uptick in the ability to deliver highly curated contextual help inside of applications, again, to make the creator more efficient and help move them along through their creative process. And these are well-established techniques, maybe not necessarily in media and entertainment, but they translate directly into them. So I see them maturing very fast and able to deliver value now. Another area where I think is where there's value to be delivered right now is around content management. Because other industries around us have moved very quickly and we can leverage those techniques and those models within our industry, especially around leveraging techniques around recommendation of content and recommendation engine technology in terms of, how do you start to recommend appropriate content for storytelling or start to use recommendations for jumpstarting the ideation process. it's mature in other industries and translates very nicely into our industry. So I do think there's value now in leveraging, and I'm seeing value now in leveraging recommendation modeling and AI techniques in this domain around content management. For distribution, again, I think there's a huge opportunity, especially given all the different modalities that we distribute content over today. But again, I don't quite see it there yet in terms of well-established and taken hold to basically, make it very simple to create once and distribute umpteen times over many different modalities and handle the various formatting and different ways you have to tweak the storytelling and imagery for the different channels. Great opportunity, but not as mature. So I feel like this opportunity across the workflow, but certainly within production and content management, there's a lot of very relevant techniques that are delivering value today.
Thank you, Kevin. I saw Rowan nodding away there. And Rowan, you've spoken to maybe a dozen plus broadcast and content creator organizations. You've spoken to many media innovators. Are there any sort of areas in particular where you've seen the other real areas of potential or areas where it's not so advanced?
Yeah, it's very hard, I think, to really assess potential in any given area, because the applications of AI can be so broad. You know, Kevin was talking there about, you know, just improving algorithms that we have in products, like, you know, tiny little feature additions. The web browser I use released a thing this week that allows them to auto sort my tabs by category, right? This is just like a neat little feature that somebody's thrown in based on AI. How do you quantify those things? But when we really look at like what are the transformational pieces in our industry, I think where I've seen the most excitement through this work is anything that involves recutting, remixing, reusing content. Kevin, again, touched on some aspects around localization and versioning. We did a report a year ago now called The Future of Localization. It didn't set out to be an AI report, but it near as damn it was, because that was where all the excitement was a year ago, and it still is. So when I look at like the highest areas of potential that we identified, things like versioning and localization, but also marketing and promotion, and advertising and monetization, these are areas that people see a great deal of potential. And it feels like we're quite nascent. It feels like we're not quite there yet, but you can see how maybe we're not expecting fully automated AI-driven program creation from scratch anytime in the foreseeable future, if ever. But a lot of these processes where we take bits of content and we want to reformat them for different devices, we want to tweak them for different audiences, we want to make them available in different countries, or we want to create trailers out of them. You know, all of these different use cases that take a piece of content, recut, remix it. I think that's the stuff that feels both high potential, but also relatively nascent in its use case.
You mentioned earlier that the last chapter, I believe, is about ethical AI or governance issues, at least. I can see what you did there with the headline now, Rowan. What does good look like? So I want to pick up on a stat I pulled out of the report. And I think it was that 30% of workshop and other, you know, member contributors responded to a question about who's got essentially overall oversight for governance, AI use in your organization. And 30% said it was either the CIO or the CTO was responsible. I believe that 35% said it was a sort of group of people encompassing maybe legal counsel and sometimes the CEO and other organizations. My question then is, with two CTOs I'm speaking to, what's the approach? Maybe Kevin, you can talk about Avid. Is it how you're approaching this? Because this is a drum I've banged with Rowan before. I did a similar piece of work in 2018, and it was quite surprising that CIOs and CTOs at the time said that they were responsible, but they kind of wished that they didn't. They said this was a job for a multidisciplinary team of everyone they could get involved, possibly even the board.
So I'm the CTO and the CIO at Avid, and I can absolutely tell you that I am not solely responsible for this. It is from the beginning on our journey in terms of, we've been upfront, as we've been experimenting and learning and then ultimately productizing with AI, we've had kind of a parallel train of, How do we use this technology responsibly, both within Avid, but also for our product development? And that has been highly cross-functional from the start. I would say the primary players have been kind of the role of CTO, CIO, played by me. My chief and equal partner in this is our general counsel and the entire legal team. And then a select group of our more tech-savvy board members that we interact with to make sure that at the corporate level, we are using this technology responsibly and not putting Avid at risk or Avid's customers at risk. That's first and foremost for us. So we have a cross-functional team of this. I would say it's really across CTO, CIO, GC, legal team, and our board. Beneath that is a series of teams that then kind of draft in and support that, support these activities. But, we've gone to great lengths to craft a very comprehensive policy around the responsible use of AI that has become mandatory reading / training for the entire company that we've pushed through the entire company. And it really embodies it embodies how we use it in our products. What are our policies around how we evaluate models and whether or not they're appropriate for use in products, whether they're, based on, do we know about the training data? Can we verify that there's no bias? Can we verify or assess the bias in training data? Can we trace verity and verify output from the algorithms? Things of that nature, right? Are they responsible to put in our products? And then putting them always in our products with toggles, and ultimately putting the decision on whether you want to use or not use the output from those algorithms in the hands of the user. And those are just some of the foundational tenets that we've agreed to as a company. But we also use AI within our company, like many other enterprises. We use Copilot for code development. Some of our marketing tools use AI in terms of how do we assess our cohorts and our end users and shape marketing campaigns and understand how to best reach them and move them through their journey. And all of these different types of technologies get fair and equal evaluation and approval and sign off for use by a governing committee within Avid, which is really primarily comprised of CTO, CIO, and GC. But then we review that quarterly with our board. So it's highly cross-functional. It's something we've taken very seriously from the beginning at Avid. It really started with our own use, but now we're also looking outwardly towards our vendors that integrate into our ecosystem, either behind the scenes or as partners that we co-sell with, and requiring the same types of policies and controls on their part as well.
Thank you. And Rowan, were you surprised about that 30% figure? Or do you think maybe if you ask the same question to the sort of a similar group in even a year's time, you'll probably hear more of a response exactly like Kevin's described?
Yeah, I think it's definitely evolving, and it absolutely does have to be a cross-functional thing, a cross-disciplinary team that makes these decisions. I mean, ultimately, we are talking about issues of intellectual property, of transparency and honesty with audiences and customers. I think people are still getting to grips with it. And there is a risk at the moment that there's a bit of kind of theatre going on around some of it. So I won't say who, but one contributor said that they've got customers asking them for an AI policy. They're pretty sure the customers don't read the AI policy or care at all about what's in it. They just want to know that there's a policy. And I think there is quite a bit of that still going on. So I think where we see the most mature organizations, they really are thinking deeply about what are the impacts here? What is the impact on their intellectual property? What is the impact of, whether they might be relying on or even infringing on anybody else's intellectual property? What are the core elements of trust they have with their customers or their audiences? And we're finding our way through that, right? There aren't simple answers today. Transparency is a bit of a watchword that keeps coming up. Though, speaking personally, I can't help but wonder whether we really know what that transparency should look like in the long term. So especially when you start talking about media companies being transparent with audiences, You sort of start to think, okay, but where do we draw the line? You know, if I've used an AI driven color correction tool, do I have to declare that to audiences? If I've used, you know, AI to replace the background of a shot without any inherent dishonesty, is it important to declare that? You know, at what point does it become important? I think we're still working all of this through, and these are not technical questions. They cannot be solved by the CTO. Or certainly not the CTO alone.
Indeed, you've mentioned this is already baked into so many things that we're doing. So I'm going to ask you, I'm going to put you on the spot, Rowan, in a sentence, what is shadow AI, which is a term you've used? And then I'm going to ask Kevin to see if it's a phrase you're familiar with and if it's sort of useful and works, is probably going to be the follow-up, actually.
So shadow AI is our new favorite to describe the principle that no matter what you do in your organization, your staff are going to use AI tools. They are going to go and get their own ChatGPT account or their own Midjourney or whatever it is, and they're going to start using it. And so organizations are grappling with, you know, what does it mean in terms of how staff will use AI? And of course, you know, it's built on the rather more familiar concept of shadow IT, the idea that users throughout the business will use software that may or may not be approved by the IT department.
I'm very familiar with that, Rowan, and I completely agree. It's we're humans, is what we do, right? It's neat new technology. It can potentially make us more efficient or make our lives easier. So we're gonna go play with it and experiment with it. And I think you can't stop human nature. But what we've tried to focus on at Avid is acknowledge that people are gonna use this technology. So how do we create the golden paths for them to use the technology in a way that is responsible and safe? For Avid and ultimately our customers. So, you know, a lot of these technologies have enterprise versions, right, that you can pay for and stand up that, you know, do not contribute back to the model or ingest whatever you're putting in for your into the typing in or cut and pasting in and absorb that into the learning and the model. And basically, you get to keep your information and what I'm most concerned about, your intellectual property. So, our philosophy is yes, we agree. It's going to happen. Let's move it from shadow AI to fully supported and promoted AI by standing up enterprise versions of what we think are those most used algorithms and lay out the golden paths that unlock the opportunity for our employees to go use those technologies, but do it in a way that keeps the enterprise protected.
Thank you both. And I would suspect it will probably follow the same trajectory of almost the consumerization of IT, the consumerization of AI. It will just be a thing that creeps in, and the tools will be sanctioned and corporatized, I suppose, eventually. I think I've got a couple of questions left for you. The first one I'm going to ask is, can you really define the characteristics of organizations that maybe you've spoken to, Rowan and Kevin, that you work with, that you think really getting the best value out of implementations or initiatives? Or are these just business projects rather than AI projects? They just happen to use them. But if you could dig a question out of there, then I'd
No,
love to hear.
it's exactly that. I think the organizations that are getting the most value, many of them do have teams that are exploring and experimenting and so on. But when it comes to getting value for the business, they are laser focused on, you know, what are the real world use cases, what are the processes we can improve, or the new things we can do, or the things that we can do faster. So there's almost nothing about the answer to that question which is specific to AI. It's the same approach as with any new technology, I think. It's being focused on what can it deliver for the business.
Yeah, I have a slight twist on that view. I agree, but with a slight twist, Rowan, which is, you know, I mean, look, in general, I think we're well past the point of whether AI is going to play a key role in the industry, right? We, you know, and as an industry, we need to work together to operationalize AI responsibly, with, to your point, Rowan, with full transparency and disclosure. But I do think AI is going to force our industry to innovate faster than ever, because just the pace of innovation around AI is moving at a speed that we're not necessarily accustomed to in our industry. And I think it's going to force us to really what I like to say is innovate and iterate in plain sight, right? So as opposed to having large multi-year technology rollout programs that then kind of get operationalized in a workflow and that workflow kind of sits there for a long time, we need to move to a model that is kind of much more fluid and iterative with both organizations and with vendors, because this is very nascent. AI is still very nascent, although to Rowan, to your point, there are some organizations are finding use cases that they believe will create real value for them. So, you know, I do think it is just another technology project. We've been through lots of disruptive technology transitions before, but I do think that media organizations that can pivot into new and faster operating patterns of adoption will kind of unlock the capacity and realize cost savings and really recognize the value of AI faster than those that cannot unlock those newer, faster operating patterns.
So that's the mechanism to get there. What if I was to put you on the spot as our last question and ask, what are some of the incoming innovations going to be? Appreciating that you've said it's going to be iterative. And it could be sort of some wild conjecture, or it could be some quite measured insight about what you might see.
Yeah, I'll go first, and then Rowan can bring me back to earth. You know, I do think I agree with Rowan. I do think there's massive opportunity for the maturation of AI in both the ingest side, but especially on the distribution side of workflows. If you just think about the media formats that we have to deal with, and the way content is distributed and has to be adapted over all the different modalities of distribution, it's a huge opportunity to simplify that part of the workflow. And I think that's just a natural thing that has to happen that we can leverage AI for in our industry. But, you know, to look a little further ahead, like what is like ultimately the vision? You know, I think my view is that in general, technology has really infiltrated the creative process. Our world that we operate in now is highly complex to a lot of the points that Rowan's are mentioned. And I think AI really needs to help this technology burden fade to black to enable an increased focus on the creative process and storytelling. Building on that, I really think, you know, innovative use cases for video and audio for that matter are going to center on building almost an AI creative partner or co-pilot. I love that term. Microsoft nailed it with that. But this partner that seeks to like jumpstart the ideation process and handle the mundane, repetitive parts of workflows for a creator. And, you know, my vision and the vision that we're driving towards at Avid is really to deliver like an in-app, like highly contextual assistant that can then drive automated behaviors in the applications. And what I think is most important about that is, you know, it changes the way that you interact with the applications within a workflow, you know, from being explicitly commanding applications to carrying out tasks to really moving to communicating intent and having the application do that for you. It doesn't mean you're not creating. It's just making you much more efficient. And, you know, what I think is central around that is if we can accomplish that within our applications, that really lowers the bar on accessibility to what is really very complex technology in our industry. It will enable our experts to generate faster, more richer content, but it'll also allow others to come into our industry with a bar that's potentially a little lower at a time when the rate of increase of content is outpacing the number of people able to serve that in our industry. And I think that will be a really, you know, a great outcome for us as we think about the out years of AI and what we're really driving towards.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I wouldn't underestimate some of the kind of boring in inverted commas sort of back office uses of AI. Like I think a lot of the use cases that we're going to see across many industries will also be impactful in ours. So the use of AI for data analytics and visualization and exploration, you know, a bunch of the sort of the business operational functions. But ultimately when it comes to media, Kevin's sort of almost taken the words out of my mouth. I think that lowering the bar of entry to make great quality content is going to be the real key. You know, we've seen that over the last couple of decades, right? You can now get some really fantastic quality content that is produced by people who would not traditionally have been considered in the professional media industry. You can do that using a piece of editing software on a commodity laptop. But a lot of the things that are still a bit of a black art, really great quality color correction and audio manipulation and all sorts of these sort of really fine detail, very skilled tasks. I have no doubt there will continue to be humans involved in the really high end of those. But I think the barrier to entry for somebody to create something that is a really good result with a lot less specialist knowledge is definitely what we're going to see. And I will leave it to the listener to decide whether that is a threat or an opportunity or both.
Hi, Malika. Thank you very much for joining the DPP podcast. The hardest questions first, actually. Could you just introduce who you are, maybe where you are as well?
Hi, Edward. Thanks for having me. My name is Malika Golkaram. I'm a product manager for Google Core Infrastructure. I'm based out of New York, and actually I've been with Google for more than 6 years now. It's been a very interesting journey. And before that, I have a long history of working in media companies such as Comcast. I was working in the tech department of TV2 Norway. So I'm very happy to be here talking about AI in media.
Thank you very much. And 6 years is the perfect time frame, actually, for what I was going to ask in my next question, because I remember some of the hype around AI that there was back at the end of the 2010s. And perhaps some of that didn't really realize immediate value compared to, say, what happened last year when everyone got much more excited and there were these product releases from different organizations. And also, you contributed to a piece of DPP work back in 2018 that's called AI for Real. Now, I'm certainly not going to ask you to remember much about what took place in that piece of work. And you also took part in a recent piece of work that our CTO, Rowan de Pomeray, led called AI in Media, What Does Good Look Like? But what really do you think has changed, if I can ask you to summarize perhaps, what has happened with artificial intelligence in that period from maybe a tech perspective or a business perspective or both?
It's an interesting question. I don't think back in 2018, AI was a hype. In fact, I think we've been using some sort of AI, either in ML form or any sort of repetitive task simplification type of work, even before 2018. Back then, the ability of models was moving towards understanding things. What do people say? What are the objects in the videos? How can we protect content rights for the creators in terms of piracy and things like that? Direct-to-consumer products such as YouTube and TikTok and whatnot have been using AI to basically detect things that are not useful for the end users, or in a way protect end users from harmful content. And that's been going well. They've been using it for a while and hasn't been a hype. And it's been very essential to cost cutting and to make content beneficial to end users. A fairly huge stream of these algorithms from 2018 onwards was used in forms of managed solution or custom built solutions for media companies, to make it available for businesses to benefit from. And here we're talking about broadcasters, agencies, and companies that are consumers of AI. From business perspective, this is continuously being backed by cost-cutting and repetitive visual tasks. For example, fewer content reviewers. It will never be zero, but fewer of them. Now, if you're fast-forwarding to today, with LLM sitting above previously ruling ML models, it's fair to say that we live in AI volume 2 of things. The big difference between what we see today versus 2018, or frankly, 2022, is the ability for models to generate things that were previously known as human artifacts. This means we're finally on the right path to meet HAL, but the quality of these models for critical roles like spaceship management that HAL did is still too poor. In space of media, there's a lot of progress being made to generate visually diverse, exciting, or satisfying results. Although some models perform better than the others, they're still very expensive to train. They're still very expensive to use. Remember, using these models is not only burning TPUs to generate a single image, but rather how many times do you have to repeat this process to get a close to authentic image that a photographer can take with a shot? And how many of these can you use on your product? But going back to AI Volume 2, something interesting is happening. A lot of the big tech companies are investigating to use LLMs to mass produce training data sets for detection models. So the models that were struggling before to detect things, to create transcription, to make content available for a diversity group of people, now can be fed with a lot more data that's very niche to their use cases. And with that, with the low quality, with the high quality and hopefully lower cost of generation of these, we might be living in a world where AI becomes commodity. And that will be very interesting to watch.
Thank you, Malika. And it made me think maybe I have an oversimplified interpretation of AI in that from around 2018, there were things that the consumer maybe couldn't see so visibly. And what's happened in the last year is with the generative piece, it's been more visible. And a lot of those innovations that you mentioned maybe weren't on the minds of your average media consumer at the time. And that's perhaps one of the things that's changed. So thank you very much for explaining that. Got, I think, one closing question for you. But in my typical style, I'm going to throw a few things into one and you're going to try and pick the relevant questions out for that. So the name of the piece of work we did was deliberately called What Does Good Look Like? And good to encompass ethical AI as well as sort of business implementation of AI. And we dedicated plenty of space to this in the report as well. So how do you see the industry and sort of media companies and their partners approach this? So one of the things that we did with a bit of a survey was ask who essentially has governance for the implementation and ethical issues and regulatory governance issues. And 30% said it was the CTO or CIO or their tech function. And I think 35% said it was, you know, a multidisciplinary group of people who came together to look at this. Others, it was the legal function. So my question to you then is, or the question is, how do you see organizations approach this? Is there a right way? Should it be solely the responsibility of tech? And also, what does good look like in terms of partnerships between media companies and the sort of supplier ecosystem? Because clearly, there aren't going to be many media organizations that do this on their own. All of the innovation is coming from organizations like your Googles and your Microsofts and your OpenAIs and others.
Yeah, that's a very good question. In a way, it reminds me of back in the days when basically video streaming became a thing and there was so much fear about piracy and ethical use of content that was previously easily monetized. The step that was taken was obviously building quite a lot of different safeguarding tools such as DRM, encryption for content protection. And it was mainly driven by tech companies back in the days. The difference between managing provenance and detecting deepfakes and basically threatening type of content with piracy is that, which, by the way, piracy could also somehow get included eventually in provenance work, because who knows if a content is generated by a broadcaster later on, is that going to be legally an IP of that broadcaster? Right now, no one owns it, but in the future, it might change. So what's interesting now is the tech companies, some of them, such as Google, for instance, we do sit on a huge amount of content thanks to YouTube. And some tech companies do and some don't. The key here is for tech companies to work on technologies that would enable the sort of detection and understanding of content that potentially can be generated. And it's right now where we sit is we all focus on the possibility of a content being generated because it's really hard to say 100% it was generated or not, even if we're sure. So the technology can be driven by tech companies, but it's the media companies who are interacting with media content. It's the news companies that day in, day out verify content that's true or not. And this has been something that historically they've been doing outside of Gen AI. They've always verified the sources and made sure something is authentic and true to be published in a news outlet. So the important thing is for all of these entities to work together and build consensus around how especially media content will have to be guardrailed against you know, misinformation, and the tech companies will provide the resources to you know, and it's also an interesting business for startups to get into, but it's the media companies who have to lead the knowledge of it and the importance of it and raise awareness why we're doing this. And we have to work with governments to understand how we should get into provenance work without trespassing users' privacy, because that's also another element that could be a barrier, but could also be very helpful to understand how we have to guardrail content.
Thank you. So it's almost the responsibility of everybody in kind of some way or other. So I'm going to put you on the spot, actually, with one closing question, if you can think on your feet, which is, what are you most excited about maybe for the next year, for the capabilities or workflows or impact that artificial intelligence might have on the media industry?
I'm very excited to see media being more diverse, because right now I feel like people with disabilities or the ethnic communities, and they live far from their families or their language or their culture, they probably get access to fewer type of content, or they can't enjoy content the way that other people can benefit in the original form. I'm also hoping that we can find a solution to this ever lingering problem of recommendation engines. We've always wanted to solve this problem, but we've somehow haven't been very successful, maybe because humans have a spectrum of moods in a day or a week, or maybe it's because there are so many facets to one particular title that we haven't really got deep into. And I'm hoping with maybe with LLMs, we can have a conversation with the recommendation engine to understand what really does the user want to watch, and why have they liked a previous title in more depth that it's not possible today.
Thank you. I kind of agree. It sometimes feel like when the recommendations are correct, it was a fluke rather than it was the sort of reverse engineered brilliantly. That was Malika Golkaram, and before that, Kevin Riley in conversation with the DPP's Rowan de Pomeray and myself. Thank you for listening. I hope you found that useful and or interesting. And check back soon for part two with Morag McIntosh from the BBC and Atelier CTO Ryan Kiddo discussing AI in media. What does good look like?